Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Ayella, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Living with Chronic Myelogenous Leukemia, or CML. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And I also do want to call out particularly the CML Society, the National CML Society. It's a wonderful resource for all of you, as well as all of the other blood cancer organizations that are on today's program and general cancer organizations as well. Now, we have many of you on the call today, well, because of all of the collaborating organizations, as well as your interest in today's program. Now, we kind of like to spread the word about the program. So we have over 582 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have participants from Canada and the United Kingdom. So you really are a bit of a global call to some extent from all over the world, and we really appreciate your taking this next hour to spend with us to learn more about living with and the treatment for CML today. Today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today and actually for their collaborative collaboration in supporting the program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, really the best of the best speakers, and so I'm going to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is LIDA, Myeloproliferative Neoplasms Program, attending physician, leukemia service, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. Dr. Morrow is going to present an overview of CML, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, and the benefits of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. And I also want to thank my co-speakers. We have a great program for you, and thank you all for joining. From all over the U.S., it sounds like, and overseas, it's fantastic. So my job, as mentioned, was to start off with an overview of CML. And probably the first thing that I always like to start off by saying is that due to tremendous research and advances over a few decades, CML is now hopefully a highly treatable and even functionally curable type of leukemia. It is one of the four major leukemias that we see, both acute and chronic myeloid or lymphoid leukemias, and is probably one of the best understood when it comes to how does it happen, or at least what makes it tick. And that's quite a bit related to how we've developed targeted treatments and our best treatment available currently. People always ask, how did I get CML? What did I do to deserve CML? And I always try to explain to people that it is really a probably the result of a common genetic error that happens in our blood, or the cells that replenish the bone marrow, the stem cells, acquire something called the Philadelphia chromosome, which is a discrete genetic exchange due to the fact that chromosomes, when cells are dividing, are close together, and there can be errors, and one can be put next to another when it shouldn't be, a juxtaposition or translocation. And you create an abnormal protein called BCR-ABL. So the Philadelphia chromosome is the blueprint, and BCR-ABL is the protein that causes the cells to misbehave. What that protein does is cause cells to persist longer than they should, to leave the bone marrow and collect into the blood, and to divide a little bit faster rate. And the symptoms of CML are generally, some can be quite variable. When blood counts are high, some people can have fatigue from a shortage, from anemia. They can have symptoms related to high blood counts, although that's less common. Many people will have symptoms in the abdomen if they have an enlarged spleen. General symptoms like fatigue, night sweats, weight loss when it shouldn't be happening are some of the common problems we see. And CML is almost always, fortunately, diagnosed in what we call an indolent or chronic phase. And it often is diagnosed serendipitously, meaning someone just having a blood test for another reason, for routine health reasons or some other medical intervention. It can be quite scary to be diagnosed with CML. It's obviously still a serious diagnosis and can have significant consequences. But again, due to tremendous advances, it's become highly treatable. We We often need to do a series of tests to ensure we understand all there is about CML, including a bone marrow biopsy to fully stage or prognosticate CML, and of course blood tests to further examine and clarify and of course confirm the presence of this Philadelphia chromosome and abnormal BCR-ABL activity, which by definition then leads us into our treatment options. And the current standard of care and for CML is a bit of a complex equation. We like to call it a spoil of riches, in that we have multiple medications available. At the current moment, three drugs, and stay tuned, we may even see more added to that list available for first treatment. And that's really a blessing because we have our oldest and most well-studied drug, imantinib, or Gleevec, which is an oral drug, much like all the other four drugs I'll mention, or my colleagues will mention. And in addition to imantinib or Gleevec, we have nilotinib, or Tasigna is its brand name, and dasatinib or Sprycel. Again, all as current first-line treatments. To round out the list, there are two other medications, bosutinib or Bosulif and ponatinib or Clusig, which I'll probably mention, or my colleagues will, of course, will mention to round out the list. What are these drugs? They are small molecule inhibitors of BCR-ABL. So the BCR-ABL is a protein that's activated and is causing the manifestations, the abnormal blood counts, is keeping the CML going. And through fantastic work in the laboratory to understanding that this chromosome abnormality was the root cause of the disease, what it led to, this abnormal protein, how the protein worked, and how we could shut the protein down, these drugs were developed to inactivate BCR-ABL or to turn it off, essentially, if it's a switch, which clears the CML, essentially doesn't fix the cells, but leads to their orderly exit and their cuts off their persistent overproduction and their reservoir diminishes over time, and people go into first blood remission and then subsequently deeper levels of remission called cytogenetic remission, where the amount of CML burden is decreasing by 10 and then 100 and then 1,000-fold decreases over initial baseline, to the point where the CML may be only detectable by molecular tests, where we can only see traces of this BCR-ABL translocation, or the Philadelphia translocation, rather, by its RNA or DNA fingerprint. And that DNA or RNA-based blood test called PCR has really become a workhorse, meaning it's much more patient-friendly, and it doesn't mean that sequential bone marrow studies or these more detailed tests are always needed. The molecular tests really do a lot of the work for us. So the odds of getting into first level of remission, a blood response, are extremely high. Nearly all patients will have hematologic remission with a first treatment, and subsequent cytogenetic and molecular responses follow thereafter. The most important thing is to, number one, be on the lookout for overcorrection of the blood, which is probably the most common side effect, if you will, of treatment, meaning rather than just going to normal blood counts can then fall below normal, and that is really part of response and just requires adjustment in treatment and potentially brief hold, potentially a dose reduction, but more often than not, working through it and hopefully sustaining the same dose that will hopefully bring the greatest odds of a deeper remission and maybe even a functional cure. There are other side effects, which I think Dr. DeBoer is going to get into, so I will defer on that. Frequent blood testing and early molecular testing tells us how well the CML volume is shrinking. And again, we have a fairly straightforward script that we want to follow, with early molecular response occurring in the first 3 to 6 months and cytogenetic or bone marrow level of response happening in the first 6 to 12 months, and molecular response, of course, happening all along, but then appearing to be at critical levels of reduction by 12 to 18 months. I tell people that life can get back to hopefully a normal or near normal with oral outpatient therapy, and they shouldn't expect to hopefully be hospitalized or to have serious complications, although, of course, a number of things could happen. One important element to mention is that, while not common, it's still standard to consider what curative approaches we have for CML, and allogeneic bone marrow transplantation is still a treatment with a high degree of success, and CML really presented one of the conditions that was most responsive and successful in stem cell transplantation. So for when someone's diagnosed with CML, it's not shouldn't be surprising or frightening to hear that stem cell transplant is something to consider. It may not be something that's recommended. It may not even be something that hopefully is necessary for most people. And someday we hope to not to have to use such intense therapy for any patient. But I think it's still worth discussing, particularly someone who's has suitable donors, is of younger age, and has a good health. The odds of success with a bone marrow transplant may be quite high, and we can't overlook that option. So I encourage people to ask about that and to know about that. Of course, there are continued research beyond the nearly 20 years of research into BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which include the medications I've mentioned. We're looking to see how to optimize response, how to bring the greatest number of patients into an early molecular response, bring the greatest number of patients into a deep molecular response. And probably some of the most exciting research, which I'll leave to Dr. Shah probably to review, is can people stop their therapy and potentially stay in remission? And there's some very exciting news in that arena. We continue to look into alternatives to our current medications, including newer BCR-ABL kinase inhibitor, so newer medications in the same vein as the ones available, oral medications with hopefully low side effect profile to work as alternatives when current available medications either were unsuccessful or raised side effects and patients had intolerance. One particular exciting drug is ABL-001, manufactured by Novartis, which is still a new drug in phase one, but fairly mature phase one testing, which is showing I would say an excellent side effect profile, clearly a strong efficacy signal across different phases of CML, and it's the first medication we can now use in combination potentially, meaning one of our currently available drugs like imatinib, nilotinib, dasatinib in combination with ABL-001. So we have a tremendous history. We have a clearly straightforward script to follow when it comes to response and monitoring. We have spoiler riches for medications, and we have research into both how we can do the best with the drugs we have available, can we bring new medications on which would do even better, and can we really finish the story by having a highly effective treatment followed by a potential for a functional cure or cure over time. All of this isn't going to happen unless we have good communication and navigate properly amongst each of our within our healthcare team, within our family, within our medical community. So the benefits of communicating with your healthcare team to close are probably one of the most important things to mention, that asking about the questions you have about your treatment, what medication's best for me, what side effects should I expect, what risks do different drugs pose, and I'll leave that also to Dr. Jabbour to cover. What is my response looking like? Am I on track? Am I not on track? I'm having problems with side effects and I need to manage them rather than feel I need to manage my own decisions and take drug holidays or stop therapy. That can be quite detrimental to our long-term success. On the physician side, we need to be aware that these questions are out there and make sure they're being there's time and there's the forum and to ask, and there are many different resources, which I think Carolyn can shed light on. She already mentioned the National CML Society and peer-to-peer and other patient advocacy groups and connections with other patients, not to mention the nursing practitioner and physicians that are in the clinic. So one can't underestimate the benefit of open communication, wide open communication, especially early and at all times during treatment. So I'm going to stop there and turn it over to my colleagues to continue the program, and I thank you for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mora, for starting off the call today, for being very comprehensive and really just a wonderful presentation. So thank you so much. Just very, very much. Lots of wonderful information. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And I should mention to people that the second half of the program, we will be taking questions. So start to kind of jot down your questions or think about them, because you'll have all of our wonderful speakers to address your questions. And our next speaker is Dr. Neil Shah. Dr. Shah is the Edward S. Agino Distinguished Professor in Hematology Oncology, Director, UCSF Molecular Medicine Residency Program, Leader, Hematopoietic Malignancies Program, Helen Dillo Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of California, San Francisco. And Dr. Shah is going to be addressing clinical trials, including clinical trial updates, the important role of adherence or taking your pills on schedule, and the significance of treatment summaries in living with CML. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Shah.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining today. So I'm going to spend probably the majority of the time talking about clinical trials. And just to, first of all, frame the importance of clinical trials, I think it's important that we all understand that every approved medication that we have, including the many approved agents that are active and effective for CML, were only granted approval following the brave participation of patients in clinical trials. And in many cases, patients were taking a drug that had never been taken by anybody else at that particular dose. And it's through that experience that we really learn about not only the activity of drugs, but sometimes the side effects as well. And so clinical trials remain a very important mechanism whereby we can hopefully further improve outcomes in patients with cancer. So as Dr. Morrow mentioned, we have almost an embarrassment of riches when it comes to effective treatments for this disease. A total of 6 therapies have been approved since the turn of the century, which is really rather remarkable. And 5 of these are in this class that we call tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and Dr. Morrow went through the names of these, including the 3 that are presently approved in the front line, which include imatinib, dasatinib, and nilotinib. And as Dr. Morrow alluded to, there's a hint that maybe bosutinib may join that, although that's not quite clear yet at the moment. But it's only through clinical trials that these drugs get their designated approval. And going back to imatinib, which is the drug that we have the longest experience with and the greatest number of sort of patient years experience with, this agent was an eye-opening agent when it first underwent clinical trial evaluation in the late 1990s and early 2000s, where it became clear that the vast majority of patients with chronic phase CML, whose disease was not tolerant or responsive to the previous medical therapy available at the time, which was interferon, that the vast majority of these patients had a very nice hematologic response, meaning their white count returned to normal, as well as a deep chromosomal response, a cytogenetic response. And this was important because we had learned from previous experience that that level of remission really predicted for a superior long-term outcome. And when imatinib was then compared in another clinical trial with interferon in newly diagnosed patients, it looked remarkably superior to interferon with respect to achieving these deep chromosomal responses. And that's what led to its approval as the preferred frontline agent back in 2001. And then subsequent what we call second-generation agents, of which there are 3, dasatinib, nilotinib, and bosutinib, came into clinical trial evaluation initially for patients whose disease was resistant or intolerant or to imatinib. And in these cases, these drugs show substantial activity, and they were initially approved in the second-line setting. But since they are all very effective inhibitors of the target BCR-ABL, they were all tested head-to-head with imatinib. And 2 out of the 3, dasatinib and nilotinib, have been given approval as frontline agents in addition to imatinib. And so starting with any of these 3 drugs at the moment, we think is really very reasonable. Imatinib has gone generic, and so sometimes for cost containment purposes, insurance companies will prefer that patients start imatinib. It is the drug that we have the greatest amount of safety experience with. We think we don't think any drug is more safe than imatinib for the treatment of CML, but it is not without its own side effects, as are all of these agents. So side effects can sometimes declare themselves during clinical trials, but occasionally for rare side effects, things that may happen in 1 out of 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 patients, we sometimes don't learn about that until after clinical trials are completed and after drugs are approved. And so we have learned, for instance, that a couple of these drugs can be associated with toxicities that we didn't appreciate so early, but the vast majority of people do very well on these drugs. Some of these toxicities include, for dasatinib, there's a very low incidence, but it seems to be a real incidence of something called pulmonary arterial hypertension, which thankfully largely improves upon stopping the medication, but this has nonetheless been observed in a very small proportion of people on this drug. And similarly with nilotinib, we've learned about what are called arterial occlusive events, which can occur in a proportion of patients, maybe as many as 5% of patients over time, that can sometimes lead to significant complications. So we need to be aware of these, and it's largely through clinical trials and sometimes in following patients after clinical trials that we really get this this information properly. So in terms of the one thing that has always been done in clinical trials is patients are encouraged to take a drug at a particular dose and at a particular schedule. And so it's critical that patients do this. We just haven't studied. So one of the limitations of clinical trials is that we don't really know, for instance, if it's possible to take drugs at different times of the day or to skip a certain number of days. And when we have great outcomes in the vast majority of people with these diseases who take drugs on regular schedules, we can sometimes feel like we're playing with fire if people start improvising, if you will, on the recommended treatment schedule. So I think it's important to of course, all realize that no drug, no even the most highly active drug for any disease, is going to be effective if people don't take it in an appropriate manner. Another thing to mention is, as Dr. Morrow had mentioned, in terms of clinical trials, one of the more exciting things recently is that we've learned that some patients, a significant proportion of patients, can have very, very deep responses on one or more of these drugs to where their disease becomes undetectable using even the most sensitive tool that we have, which is a PCR test. And numerous studies have now shown that people who achieve sustained deep molecular responses can actually try going off their drug under very careful supervision. And about 50 to 60% of them seem to be able to remain off treatment for a prolonged period of time, you know, more than 5 years and counting. We don't yet know whether this is going to be something that is lifelong for these patients, but we do have, at my own institution, a woman who became pregnant many years ago and was not on a clinical trial, had to stop her medication because she wanted to continue with the pregnancy. And she's never gone back on and has remained in a sustained complete molecular response, and it has been 14 years. And so there's hope that this will be the case for, as I said, 50 to 60% of people who achieve this level of remission in the first place. The worst thing that's happened in people that don't are not unable to maintain remission is they just have to go back on the drug and they end up regaining response. As a result of a large number of clinical trials that have been done and have shown that this can be safe to do in patients who are being appropriately monitored, it's now considered safe enough that it can be done outside the context of a clinical trial. But it is critical that you and your physician talk in detail about the monitoring and that you check in with a CML specialist to ensure that you are an appropriate candidate for treatment discontinuation. So the last thing I just want to mention briefly is that it's critical for patients to really take ownership of the disease, not only in terms of, you know, making sure that they have access to medications, they're taking their medication as prescribed, but also that they keep their records up to date, because Their care can be optimized by actually having these records on hand for any and unanticipated either consultations with other physicians or emergency situations. Having your own, a copy of your own records is really the it limits the delays that can sometimes happen when one has to try to retrieve records from another source. Sometimes patients have to pay for that, but I think if you actually ask your physician and if you take notes of when you start a medication, of side effects that you have, that can be incredibly helpful to your physicians down the road to sort of like put everything together and review where you are and think about other options as necessary and next steps and so on. So it's really critically important, I think, that that patients keep their own treatment summaries as a way of sort of empowering them to really take charge of their own health. So I think my time is up, and I'm going to pass it back over to the moderator.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Shah. That was excellent, really very, very comprehensive and really a lot of excellent information for everybody on the call in terms of just a lot of inspiring information in terms of just the options that everyone has in terms of their treatment and also in terms of concepts about taking your pills on schedule and how that seems to be working in this and for the people living with CML. So very important. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A because this is a very important topics here. And our next speaker is Dr. Elias Jabbour. And Dr. Jabbour is Associate Professor, Department of Leukemia, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Jabbour is going to address managing post-treatment side effects and weight effects, follow-up with your oncologist and primary care provider, and your quality of life concerns. It's really my great pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Jabbour.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Thank you for the opportunity of inviting me and for being here today with you. So my next 10 minutes will add to what my colleagues, Dr. Morrow and Shah, already alluded to. I want to start where Dr. Shah ended his talk about ownership. And today, you own the disease, you own your future, and we're working with you, with our patients, to secure the best outcome. We're lucky to be in a world where CML today can be a chronic disease, and patient can have a normal lifespan. We have several options. We have several medication that our patients are taking, and if they do take their medicine and they do respond very well, they can expect to have a normal lifespan like anybody else. And ultimately, Dr. Shah mentioned at the end, stopping therapy, it's a feasible goal. But in order to get to this level of response and stopping therapy, or to this level of stopping therapy, we need to take our medicine and have a good response. Therefore, we need to start with an excellent communication between the patient and the caregiver about the treatment options available, the expectations, the side effects, the milestone that we need to monitor and follow in order to get to where we want to be. Most of our patients who do not get to where they're supposed to be to get are mainly because they do not take their medicine, or they face safety concern that force them to drop the medicine and therefore not having the optimal outcome. So side effect control is really important. Supportive care is part of what we do every day. Now, some of the side effects are very common to all tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Some of them are very specific. And we get to point, because we have so many options, to tailor our therapy, to tailor the drug, to prescribe the drug that suits a patient profile in the best way possible. And I will come back to that. But let's start. When you have somebody with a high count, you need to start on tyrosine kinase inhibitors. In a frontline setting, you can go for imatinib, dasatinib, or nilotinib, maybe bosutinib as well in the future. So how I pick my drug? Well, depends on, we mentioned the payer, the insurance, the risk of the disease, whether you have somebody with high tumor burden, big spleen, high white count, or minimal disease discovered incidentally, or if we have a young patient in whom we want to aim to start therapy down the road. In any drug we choose up front, we have to watch carefully for the count, and therefore the patient should return often to their caregiver to do follow-up on their blood test, to check the platelets, the white count, the hemoglobin, because sometimes we have to hold therapy if the count is so low instead of pushing harder and to get to the point where the patient is admitted to the hospital where we have to stop therapy for longer. So it's really important early on to check the count and adjust the treatment dose accordingly, sometimes to give a break and resume therapy. So monitoring is very important early on. And all drugs we prescribe, because we have a packed bone marrow at the beginning with bad disease, we clean the bone marrow and have a window period where our count is low. We can hold therapy and resume at a lower dose or the same dose, depends on the depth of the myelosuppression, what we call the lower count, or the severity of this complication. You know, certain drugs may cause more myelosuppression than others, but on average, we have to follow very carefully. Sometimes we see the count dropping does not mean we need to stop therapy. Often we get patients referred to us because the count is low, but not too low, lower than it what it was at the baseline. So we have a dialogue with your doctor. Not always we have to hold therapy, but we have to acknowledge this side effect. Now, we have several options, and again, I said some side effects are more specific toward one drug or the others. For example, when we start a drug called dasatinib, whether we do it in a frontline setting or a relapse setting, we do face sometimes pleural effusion, mean fluid in the lungs. And that can happen early on or later on in patients who are responding well. So in somebody with cough, shortness of breath, they don't feel very comfortable, consult your doctor and get an X-ray done, because that is easily manageable. We can hold the count, we can hold the treatment, wait for the recovery, give some steroid, and we can resume therapy later on at the same dose or reduced dose, and that can overcome this problem. That is the most specific side effect encountered seen with this drug. In contrast with nilotinib, we do see more of the vascular events. We do see what we call vascular occlusive events. So when you're on a drug, you want to watch for hypertension. Diabetes should be better controlled. So I encourage you not to only have a conversation with your oncologist or medical provider, but mainly with your cardiologist if you have one, with a nephrologist who's following you for hypertension, because we've seen some disturbance in the in the blood pressure that can predict some vascular events that you should be aware of. Buzotinib is a drug that can cause diarrhea. So early on, when we start a treatment early on, we can see a diarrhea happening in about 80% of our patients. Again, I go back to the dialogue and have this open communication and discussion, and get supportive care if you need pills that can hold diarrhea but can help you to get the drug in order to avoid diarrhea. And then we had ponatinib, a drug, it's a very potent drug that was approved for patients who failed other tyrosine kinase inhibitors and who acquired certain specific mutations. This drug has shown to cause vascular events. We've seen patients coming to the clinic with hypertension that has been disregarded because patients are stressed, they're driving, they're coming, they're flying, coming to the hospital. But then we've seen later on some people having ischemic attacks, stroke, MI. Yeah, it's scary if I mention, but we can predict who's going to have this event. So, for example, somebody who was taking the higher dose of the drug at 45 milligrams per day is at higher risk of having this event. We know at a lower dose, outcome is better. We know that patients who have a risk factor, they're not controlled. For example, hypertension that is not well treated, they may be at higher risk of vascular event down the road. What I'm trying to say to you today is, when we see the patient, we need to assess his risk problems for side effect and decide accordingly. For example, if I have somebody in my clinic with history of smoking, lung injuries, I know this risk factor can predispose for fluid in the lungs and on dasatinib therapy, so I may avoid dasatinib and go for other option. In contrast, if I have a patient in my clinic who had diabetes, who had hypertension, who had stent placed in his heart for whatever reason, then I know the risk of vascular event is higher with nilotinib, so I may pick another medicine. Now, if I don't have a choice, I know carefully to follow this patient and make sure the side effects are being, the vascular risk factors are being monitored very carefully, adjusted in order to minimize any complication down the road. So bottom line is we have several options available, and I think we can adjust them and make sure the patient is taking the right dose of the drug, daily as possible and responding very well, and that secure the best outcome. Finally, when I get to the point when I stop therapy, when I get what we call treatment-free remission, to get there, we need to be taking the medicine, having the deepest response possible for as long as possible, and stop therapy, and that is feasible. And there is assessment for quality of life before and after, and the quality of life does not seem to be affected. It's good, but bottom line is having an open dialogue with your team, own your disease, watch for any side effect, communicate them, and be proactive and try to control them as long as you're responding. This is where you can get to a point where you have the best response and the best survival possible. I will stop here and I will join my colleagues for any panel discussion. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Jabbour. That was excellent and really an excellent review of some of the potential side effects and how to deal with them and how to work with your healthcare team. So I really appreciate that. And these are the kinds of things that I know there'll be questions of as well. And just before we take questions, and as you're writing down your questions, all of you who have been listening, I do want to say a few words just about the support services that are available to you, the psychosocial support services that are available to you from Cancer Care. So Cancer Care offers an array of services, from practical and financial assistance to people living with CML and living with cancer, as well as the opportunity to talk to one of our master's level trained oncology social workers for counseling services, which really means counseling is a word that really means a chance to talk with a trained professional about some of your concerns or worries or just in terms of problem solving. And we do this on the telephone. We do this online as well. And we also have telephone and online support groups. And indeed, the best way to reach us on the telephone is to call 1-800-813-4673. And of course, for many of you who prefer to contact us on the via the web, I would say to contact our website at www.cancercare.org. And you can post your question or concern, and one of our oncology social workers will then contact you. And this is true for people in the U.S. as well as our international participants. So don't feel that because you can't call us that you can't email us and we won't get back to you. And on our website, there is room for you to post your question and then have one of our staff get back to you and really engage in terms of the services that you would find helpful. I can't say enough in terms of the role of support often, and many of you know this. Many of you may live in communities where there really isn't anyone else living in that community that you know that perhaps is living with CML or with cancer. You may not know anyone to talk to about this. And so many people find a telephone support group or an online support group very helpful, or even just having a social worker who is familiar with some of the concerns, a person to talk to outside of your own support network as a place to take some of your concerns and worries. And of course, you do have your treating healthcare team. And there are also, in addition to Cancer Care, there are many cancer organizations throughout the country. And we do also help to link you up with them. And many of them are listed, of course, on our material so that you can actually look at them. And you'll be getting those information from us after the program today. Well, with that being said, we do now have time for questions. And I know you're eager to start asking questions. So I am going to ask, Ayala to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and so I'm going to leave it to Ayala to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1.
And so we do have a question from one of our online participants. And I'm going to direct that question really to start with, to Dr. Morrow. And the question is, in terms of what causes CML, it's a question that comes up a lot, and people are always asking, how did this happen to me? And so one of our online participants is asking, what causes CML? So Dr. Moore, if you could address this in a general way, of course, everyone's different, but it probably would be helpful to have that that information for people.
Sure. I think that's probably the first thing someone thinks about. What did I do wrong? What did I do to deserve this? How could I have prevented this? I think we're certainly getting smarter and smarter when it comes to epidemiology and understanding how cancers happen. Much better understanding of the genetic code and how things happen. Probably what we can say about CML is we don't know, which is unfortunate. What we do know is that this Philadelphia chromosome event, which is unique, is the first genetic event linked to a human cancer and probably one of the strongest examples of how one thing can go wrong in a cell and cause a cancer, is probably a pretty common error that can happen in blood cells. There were some studies that showed that if you looked at people who don't have CML and use very sensitive testing, you might be able to catch what probably is a transient appearance of this abnormality, the Philadelphia chromosome in cells, and that may never amount to or lead to CML. So it's probably a perfect storm, as I often try to explain to patients and you out there, that probably an error in the blood, which is always actively dividing and turning over under the right circumstances, persists and expands and leads to a diagnosis of CML. The only clear example we have might be, unfortunately, nuclear weapon use during the World Wars with in Japan, more cases of CML amongst survivors or those afflicted in that terrible incident. Otherwise, there are many suspects, things like radiation, power lines, pesticides, you know, other things are probably potentially contributors, but we just don't have a clear instigation or link. And that's probably the case with a lot of our leukemias.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Shah, do you wish to add anything to that?
No.
Okay, excellent. Okay. And another question, and I'm going to direct this question to Dr. Shah. How does CML differ from other leukemias? Are treatment options extremely different for each type of disease? Dr. Shah, if you could address this in a general way.
Yeah, it's very important to realize that, I think as Dr. Morrow mentioned, there are in general four broad classes of leukemia, of which CML is one. Because sometimes when people are first diagnosed, you know, they may have heard of somebody with leukemia whose disease was very aggressive, who did not do well, and they may automatically think, well, this is, you know, this is down the road for me as well. But and many of the people they talk to, that may be their first reaction as well, is that that it's a disease that is going to be very aggressive. What we know about CML and how it differs from certainly acute myeloid leukemia or acute lymphoblastic leukemia is that if left untreated, it will, over the course of on average about 5 or 6 years, become more aggressive and potentially become life-threatening. That's if left untreated. Whereas these other types of leukemia, if left untreated, will become life-threatening within a matter of just a few weeks or months. And so this is a critical difference between CML and acute leukemias. So the treatments, as Dr. Morrow alluded to, have been really very rational in terms of their development for the most part in targeting the underlying genetic abnormality which drives the disease. And as a result, these five approved tyrosine kinase inhibitors are all, you know, very effective. Not the other leukemias are unfortunately not as well treated in general as CML is.
Excellent, thank you. And Dr. Morrow, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that was a very good answer.
Excellent. Excellent team here. Okay. So we have another of our online participants are terrific today. Another question that we have here is about why, this I'm going to give to Dr. Morrow, why does my CML specialist watch my thyroid function each visit?
Well, first of all, I'd like to compliment that doctor. That's great that they're keeping an eye on it. two main reasons in my mind would be some of the symptoms we see during treatment might make one think about thyroid either under or overactivity. We want to watch for cardiovascular adverse effects. We're often hearing about fatigue and other symptoms. So that might be one reason. And I think it's always good to make sure someone with CML who's going to have long treatment for years, it's a marathon, not a sprint, and who hopefully is going to get into remission, stay in remission, and have a normal lifespan, as Dr. Jabbour mentioned, which is such a fantastic place to be, that we have to take care of the whole patient. So that might be the job of an internist or even a specialist if needed, but I think the oncologist perhaps sometimes fills that role often. The other important reason to mention is that thyroid medication, if someone's on it, often needs to be adjusted depending on the medicine you're on. For example, Gleevec can change the amount of thyroid replacement medication someone might need just because of the way the medicines interact with thyroid, which is being carried in the blood by certain proteins. So there may be interactions, and that's a very wise physician, and I encourage that type of approach where we don't forget about someone and their entire health picture, their internal medicine picture, and particularly their cardiovascular health, as Dr. Jabbour mentioned, and we all know is an important piece of taking care of someone with CML.
Excellent. Okay. And Dr. Shah, do you want to add anything? Or?
Yeah, I would just echo that and say that I've certainly seen some patients start one of these drugs, and all of a sudden their thyroid, the test that monitors their thyroid function can change rather dramatically, and in some cases they can require much more thyroid medication, or in some cases less. And so we sometimes are quick to sort of ascribe certain side effects to the drugs when, in fact, they may be due to the drugs, but maybe through another mechanism that is potentially treatable in a way that can certainly help a patient, feel better and tolerate treatment as well. So I think it is important to periodically check thyroid function, in particular in patients with a history of thyroid disease, but I do it occasionally in patients with no prior history because of some evidence that these drugs can sometimes predispose to thyroid fluctuations in thyroid function.
Excellent, thank you. And we have a question. I'm going to direct this question to Dr. Morrow. What's the difference between a bone marrow aspiration and a bone marrow biopsy?
Great technical question. So the bone marrow is where the blood's made, and it's in many bones, but the ones we can access are generally the iliac bones and the hip, the big wing bones which sit above the hip joint. There are other places like the sternum, but we rarely have to access the bone marrow from that site. And what we're doing when we take a bone marrow test is I always tell people, imagine the bone marrow is like a kitchen sponge that's wet but also rock hard, especially under the surface. A bone marrow aspiration is where we get access to that space where there might be the fluid part of the bone marrow, which looks like blood for the most part. It's like fatty blood. And we aspirate some of it. We take some of the cells out or the material out, and we're looking for the constituents, the counts, the what types of cells are there and what proportions and how do they look. And we can sample for the markers of CML from those cells. A bone marrow biopsy would be as if we took a core sample, which is about the size of a piece of spaghetti in caliber, and it's a tiny piece, maybe about an inch or less in length. That is like taking a piece of the sponge, like you hollowed a tiny core of the sponge out, so you could see both the liquid part and the bone part to see how they interact, the cellularity, the look at it undisturbed, if you will, because when you aspirate the marrow, you're just taking the cells out of their natural environment. And those two tests are often both helpful in conjunction with each other to understand the bone marrow health, degree of remission, making sure there aren't any other abnormalities in the bone marrow, such as scarring or disordered blood growth, which sometimes can happen, or anything else for that matter. So that's the difference between a bone marrow biopsy and a bone marrow aspirate, and they're often done together.
Excellent. Wow, thank you. That's excellent. So these are really great questions. And now I have another question actually for Dr. Shah. So I've heard of a trial that combines Gleevec and interferon to cure CML. Can you speak more about this?
Yeah, so interferon, I did not talk in detail about, other than I referenced it as a therapy that was available prior to the year 2000. And, you know, I think you can say it was the first, you know, medical therapy to show any meaningful signs of activity. By meaningful, I mean that, you know, a proportion of people clearly live longer when treated with interferon. And in fact, you know, there are some people who were treated with interferon 30 years ago almost, and maybe for a couple of years, and had deep remissions, and then stopped their treatment, and have not had to be treated with anything since then. So this therapy we think of can be curative, but the problem is it's for a very small number of people. And number two, that it's associated with significant side effects that make it not very practical for the vast majority of CML patients. And so that led to the pressing need to develop these tyrosine kinase inhibitors like imatinib. And so the question is, interferon works through somehow stimulating the immune system, presumably to recognize and control chronic myeloid leukemia cells. And so it has a different mechanism of action than these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And so there's reason to hope that if you have two drugs that work through different mechanisms of action, maybe together they can actually drive down deeper, they can achieve deeper levels of response. And there have been studies done that have looked at this, large studies, and one of the studies that was done in France actually found that the rate of achieving a deep molecular response if you added interferon to imatinib was significantly higher after 24 months than if you just took imatinib alone. And so with this in mind, as we discussed, if one of the goals of treatment, at least for some people, is to ultimately get off therapy altogether, maybe their situation would be helped if they were to combine two agents that act in different manners, or for which there's significant laboratory evidence that the combination might be superior at achieving deep molecular responses. And so there are a number of studies that have been reported. The magnitude of benefit when you add interferon to drugs like imatinib is actually comparable to if you just took one of the second generation agents. So if you took dasatinib or nilotinib, for instance, rather than imatinib plus interferon. While there haven't been direct head-to-head comparisons of these different treatments, if you just look at response rates, it would appear that adding interferon to imatinib would achieve about the same amount of efficacy as potentially starting a second-generation agent. Maybe the starting a second-generation agent would be associated with less toxicity. One might anticipate that than the combination of interferon with imatinib. But there's also been now studies of combining interferon with second-generation agents, such as dasatinib. And these have been pretty intriguing thus far. So I think there's definitely more to learn from these types of studies. And for people who are motivated, I want to again stress the only way we're going to continue to move the needle here in terms of outcomes and getting more people into deep remissions and hopefully getting more people to ultimately be able to stop therapy is through continued participation in clinical trials.
Excellent. Wow. Dr. Moore, do you want to add? Or?
I think you said it all.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. And we have another question from one of our online participants. And I'm going to direct this question to Dr. Morrow. My medications are delivered to my home while I'm at work, and as summer is approaching, I'm afraid they might melt a little in the heat. If this happens, is it still safe to take them? How can I avoid this, or are there extra requests that I can make regarding delivery?
A good logistics question, and I don't know if we have, and I bet your pharmacy colleagues give us even more detailed answer. I don't know if we have a a strong sense for what would happen with extremes of temperature, but it is to be avoided. I think I would definitely pursue more detailed instructions for the courier service, or even to speak with the provider, the specialty pharmacy, which is where our oral cancer therapies like this are often distributed, to make sure that it's delivered safely. I don't suspect there's going to be an activation or a significant change, but I suspect there could be, and they should not be exposed to either extreme, although cold would be probably less injurious to the drug than heat, and just to work with the courier and the insurance company. So I would advocate that people do that. You don't want it sitting on a hot porch at 110 degrees for a couple of days.
That's an excellent, it's a very interesting question. We've never, in all our years of doing these programs, no one's ever asked a question like this, I have to say. And this is a great question. I think the idea of talking directly with the pharmacy or the prescriber or everybody in terms of, you know, what should you do, because it's a great question. And actually, and for anyone else wondering the same thing, definitely then I think the concept of going back to the specialty pharmacy, the pharmacist, and asking that question and then working some plan out. And Dr. Shah, do you wish to add anything to that as well? This is Polio.
Yeah. Thank you. And I thought that was a very good explanation. I guess the only thing I would add is that it goes without saying, really, that these are life-altering medications. These are expensive medications, and we need to do everything that we can to ensure that they get to patients, you know, appropriately, having been appropriately temperature controlled and stored. I believe most of the bottles will say, you know, temperature not to exceed some temperature, maybe like 85 degrees or something like that. And so pharmacists will generally be up to date on all of this information. But I would definitely, I agree with Dr. Morrow that I would take this up and just say, this is critically important medication. I want to ensure that its activity is not diminished. We don't think that there's a safety issue as far as the drug becoming something toxic. It's more, is the drug going to lose its activity if it's not appropriately stored? And that's the bigger concern in my view.
So that actually can we just in general then suggest that people ask that question, even if it's there sitting in their house and it's 110 degrees, would people want to check about what the proper temperature is for these medications and things like that, which would be for everybody on the call, for all medications, for anything that, is that too much of a generalization? Dr. Morrow and Dr. Shah, is that something that really just applies here?
No, I mean, as Dr. Shah said, you know, this is we're only strong as our weakest link. So if there's anything to do with the medication and make sure the medication is exactly what we would need it to be, because everything flows forward from that. So we have to make sure that we're starting on the right foot. And your comment, Carolyn, about all medications in general, you'd be surprised. You know, so many things to say. Out of children's hands, in a safe place, in the right place, so it's accessible and reminding you to take it, whatever tools you need to remind you how to take it. Take it when you travel. Make sure you have authorization to carry your medications with you. Make sure it doesn't go on the checked luggage often if you can avoid that, because that can be extremes of temperature. So many things to talk about. And the pharmacist, especially an oncologist, oncology pharmacy, can run through these and give great advice to patients and family.
That's an excellent thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
If I can just, yes. Can I just add one quick
Please.
Thing? So on this topic, I picked up a bottle of imatinib, and it basically says store at 77 degrees, excursions, meaning you can deviate from that, to between 59 and 86 degrees. And so I think people have looked at the stability of the medication and have found that you want to basically be between about 60 and 85 degrees, at least for imatinib. And so this information is there on the bottle, generally speaking, and it should be available, and efforts should be undertaken to ensure that the temperatures do not exceed the recommended temperature.
Well, I have to say, this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank our speakers. You've been really phenomenal. You can't hear us applauding, but we are. It's been fantastic. And all of you have asked such really great questions, really thoughtful questions that really allow us to expand in ways that each call, you know, of course, you have your own unique questions, but some of these questions are really, they're just fantastic questions. So I can't thank you enough as an audience for your really engagement and participation and asking questions. And I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program and that I recognize that many of you have questions now that you still haven't had answered, or you have questions that you're going to think of in a couple of days and you're going to want to ask. Let me give you some tips of where you might get your questions answered. Of course, your treating healthcare team, they know you best, of course. They actually know you the very best, of course, of everyone. So they're a wonderful place to start. But sometimes I know you like to go other places for information. So we often recommend, of course, contacting the National Cancer Institute. They have a toll-free number, 1-800-422-6237. But they also have a website, www.cancer.gov, and it has a live chat feature so that you can actually post your question and one of their information specialists will do their very best to help you to address it or get some general guidelines or principles that you can take back to your treating healthcare team. So it's a very credible site. And of course, all of the groups that are listed as collaborating organizations on our program today, those are, and there's so many of them actually, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the CML Society, Cancer Support Community, the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, Leukemia Research Foundation. There are just so many organizations that I would have to take another 15 minutes to address them all, but they are listed and you'll all get them when you get your evaluations. And you'll be able to see these as resources that you can contact. And then for those of you who'd like to access further services from Cancer Care, then you would simply call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673, or you could visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, we don't want anyone to leave this program today feeling that you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of this really community of support and that we're all here to help you. And we know that you all have moments when you feel alone or don't know quite what to do. And it's okay to call these organizations for help. It's free. It's a free service. And we have people who can assist you with your concerns or at least have someone you can talk to. Sometimes people just feel like there's just no one that they can talk to. And that's a terrific thing to have someone that you feel you can talk to. I also want to mention a series that we're doing called Life with Cancer, A Guide to Getting the Best Care. And it's lots of different topics. And I would recommend you'll be getting information about that you can look at the different topics and see if there's one that's of interest to you. We are doing one tomorrow on understanding the costs of care and your healthcare coverage. So if that's of interest, you may want to sign up for that one. And there's a bunch of others coming up. It's a 5-part series. So again, I want to thank you for your participation today. Really an outstanding program. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.